This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
What we need to have is a real end-to-end early warning system. So really from understanding hazards, so where and what could happen here, then to observing it, having better measurements, having better then also better prediction models, and then also a warning system that works.
That's World Meteorologist Organization official Stefan Ullenbroek on steps that can be taken to mitigate future weather events. Details coming up. Also, the annual United Nations General Assembly meeting is getting underway in New York. And Gabon's military junta says there will be no school enrollment fees for the first time. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Civil engineering experts warned for years that floods posed a huge danger for two dams that were supposed to protect almost 90,000 people in northeast Libya and should be regularly maintained. That did not happen as separate governments in the east and west were vying for control of the North African country. Meteorologists also say residents did not heed an early warning. Stefan Ullenbroek, director of hydrology and water at the World Meteorological Organization, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that early warning systems can make a huge difference in saving lives as climate change-related weather events are expected to become more and more frequent, especially in Africa.
Early warning systems can be the most effective to really prevent disasters. There is quite a number of studies that demonstrate that every investment in putting early warning system pays back to society big time, as climate change adaptation, etc. What we need to have is a real end-to-end early warning system. So really from understanding hazards, so where and what could happen here, then to observing it, having better measurements, having better then also better prediction models, and then also a warning system that works, you know, that we inform society and that society is also enabled and directed in their action. In the Libya case, my understanding is that 72 hours before the major rainfall on the 10th of September, there was a state of emergency was declared. There was a warning for severe weather was issued by the meteorological office. Probably it was very difficult at that stage to really predict this super extreme rainfall that we have never observed before. So it was really very, very extreme. That was difficult to assess for the experts. On the other hand, I'm not sure why, if it was issued that warning, why it wasn't follow up. So what I read is it was sent by email and the media was used to inform the population, but it seemed to insufficiently implemented or followed up. So why exactly is a good question.
Could part of that be there just isn't one national government in place?
Yeah, the governance really has to work, has to really function in these countries. And we observe that in other countries as well, that if we have sometimes transboundary river basins or in different states, and then sometimes information is not shared in time and not followed up on. We even observed that at this major flooding in Germany 2 years ago, where we had 200 people were dying, and it was in two different states, and there was also a warning was issued by the Weather Service of Germany, a country which is, you consider, you know, they are among the best hydrologists in the world. They were prepared, good measurements, good models, everything. But even there, warnings were issued, but not really followed up. Then if you have a country which is in political very difficult situation, and even two parties are trying to rule and govern the country, it's very difficult to have the necessary governance structure to minimize impact of hazards.
The warnings did come true in the early morning of September 11th, when residents woke up to these loud explosions, floodwaters that were pounding in from the sea. Then they found out that these two dams broke. Mm-hmm. Could that have been avoided? What about the infrastructure in Derna?
Mm. I need to admit that I haven't been there and I'm not the local expert. However, from what I read, there were two dams that bursted and there was just extraordinary rainfall. The dams, at least the one which I found a bit of more information, that was built in the early mid-70s. by engineering company in former Yugoslavia. I assume it was done well, you know, probably it was done before climate change and before we were able to assess what kind of design we would need for such events. And nowadays we would very likely design this differently. And then second, what is very important for hydraulic infrastructure, that you constantly provide proper maintenance, huh? That you properly take care of the dam and look at the overflow, look at the spillway, make sure that there's no sediment blocking any spillway, and et cetera, et cetera. And
if this it sounds like from several reports that that was not done.
I don't think so. From what I saw, that was not done properly, and therefore this is a risk.
That's Stefan Ullenbrook, Director of Hydrology and Water at the Meteorological Organization. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Geneva. South African cities Tshwane and Johannesburg are facing a water crisis with the supplier Rand Water, warning its systems could collapse if consumption is not reduced. Rand Water blames high consumption during dry, warm weather, but city authorities say the supplier's systems do not have enough pressure to satisfy demand. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Some residents in suburbs south of Johannesburg have gone for nearly 20 days without water. Area councillor Faeza Cham says the shortage is crippling the lives of residents.
Issue is quite dire because our schools are not operating. Our clinics had to close. We've got about 7 old age homes, which is in this ward. The people do not have water. Our toilets are filling up. So the problem is really, really quite huge. So we don't have a proper solution.
Residents of Tshwane seem to be experiencing even greater shortages. Tshwane Mayor Silas Brink blames Rand Water, saying its systems just do not have enough pressure to supply all areas.
This has happened before and we expect it to be addressed. Unfortunately, as time has gone on, the information from Rand Water's side has become less and less clear, to the point that we have even asked to discuss this matter with the minister.
Rand Water, however, says the cities are to blame for allowing increased usage by residents. Rand Water spokesperson Makenosi Maru says the cities need to start imposing restrictive measures to avoid crashing the system.
At the current moment, what we are facing is fire consumption due to high temperatures. So we are still supplying the liters that we normally supply as rainwater, but the consumption is too high.
Nombuso Shabalala is the spokesperson for Johannesburg Water, which controls distribution in the city. Shabalala says the city has implemented level 1 water restriction measures.
Johannesburg Water is pleading with customers to urgently reduce water usage. This comes as water consumption continues to increase, which is affecting supply. High potable water consumption may result in a collapse of the system, which will cause intermittent water supply.
This is the start of the country's dry season, which lasts until March. Water experts have warned that the aging infrastructure and failure to plan for the increasing population in cities could lead to disastrous consequences for residents, not only in the two cities, but across the country. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Tuso Kumalo.
World leaders are gathering in New York City for the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly, which begins today. VOA reporter Peter Cloti is there at the United Nations, and we have him on the line to tell us about this annual gathering. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Peter.
Thank you very much. Yes.
So, what is the scene where you are, Peter, as world leaders arrive in New York and the city becomes congested?
Well, you just mentioned it, Yehias. The city is congested, especially around the UN building here in Manhattan. There were several roadblocks. Even one of the tunnels was blocked to allow some of these heads of states to easy access to travel, and there are motorcades all over the place. Some residents of New York, especially those who ply their trade, those who work around the UN, usually this is not a pleasant thing for them. Some of them tell me that during this time, especially the taxi and the Uber drivers, they find it difficult because there's traffic all over town. They don't make the amount of money that they used to make routinely during this period, although they can only get to about two or three blocks near the UN due to security concerns. So those are the issues that people are dealing with. But a lot of these leaders have arrived and they are ready to begin the high-level debate, which effectively begins tomorrow, Tuesday. Yeah.
So we'll be talking about a lot of topics in the coming days. But for now, Peter, tell us about the Sustainable Development Goals Summit taking place just ahead of the General Assembly opening.
Indeed, Yeheyes, the two-day Sustainable Development Goals Summit, which began today, ends tomorrow. It was organized by the UN General Assembly President, and the summit will aim to mark the have the deadline set for achieving the 2030 agenda and the Sustainable Development Goals. It will be the centerpiece of the high-level week of the General Assembly, and it will respond to the impact of multiple and interlocking crises facing the world. It is expected to reignite a sense of hope, optimism, and enthusiasm for the 2030 agenda. Some countries have not been able to meet the threshold at this point, at this half point, and that is why this summit, observers tell me, is important for them to encourage these political leaders to, you know, to demonstrate more commitment, to put more effort into achieving these halfway targets in order for the world to come to an equilibrium based on the agenda of the Sustainable Development Goals in 2030. So that is what is going on here in New York. And this summit marks a new phase of what experts tell me is the accelerated progress towards the Sustainable Development Goals, with high-level political guidance on transformative and accelerated actions ahead of the 2030 target ahead.
And Peter, finally, I'm sure you'll be talking to some of the African leaders attending the summit in the coming days. What are the major issues African leaders are likely to focus on?
Well, thank you very much, Hey. As we've made, you know, very committed efforts to get in them to speak with us. But two key major things on this UN General Assembly agenda are, one, the climate crisis and the impact it's having on these African countries, and the ongoing war in Ukraine, which is also having a devastating effect on the economies in the in several African countries. As you know, a lot of African countries say they bear the brunt of climate change and crisis, and have been calling on wealthier Western nations to help finance efforts to cushion the effect of climate change. They often argue that the wealthier nations contribute significantly more to conditions that expedite, accelerate climate change. So let's see how things will go regarding the debate and the resolutions or outcome of the debate on steps and commitment by these countries towards combating climate change. And of course, the war in Ukraine, you've heard a lot of these African countries talking about its impact it's having on their economies. High inflation, prices of goods and services are going through the roof. Public sector workers, private sector workers are unhappy about the economic conditions because of these economic challenges that they are facing. So let's see what outcomes these leaders will come up with, and the commitment to try to resolve or come up with solutions to help some of these countries to surmount these challenges they face in their respective countries.
VOA's Peter Cloete reporting from the United Nations headquarters in New York. Thank you for your input, Peter.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Tens of thousands of children in Gabon who are returning to school will not be paying enrollment fees for the first time after the military junta declared education would be free. However, many families say the high cost of living still makes it difficult to send children to school. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Gabon's military junta said tens of thousands of school children returned to school on Monday after a summer vacation 2 weeks later than originally planned. The military seized power from President Ali Bongo Ondimba shortly after he was proclaimed the winner of August 26 elections and pushed back the opening of school. The ruling junta, led by acting president General Brice Oligui Nguema, last week declared school would be free. 16-year-old Nga Herodia is in the first year of the sixth form at the Immaculate Conception Institute in the capital Libreville. She says all the school children were excited about catching up with friends and teachers after a very long vacation. Nga told state television she and her peers spent the first several hours in school talking about the military takeover. Emmanuel Mve is a member of Environment Gabon, a coalition of non-profit environmental protection groups. He says poverty and rising prices are making it difficult for parents to send children to school. He spoke to VOA via a messaging app from Bitam, a town on Gabon's northern border with Cameroon.
Nous sommes contraints de faire appel à votre autorité.
He says civil society activists want the new military leadership to improve living standards of all citizens and bridge the huge gap between the rich and the poor. He says poverty is accentuated by the lack of drinkable water and electricity in the majority of the country's villages. Mve said there has been an unprecedented rise in food prices since Russia's war in Ukraine started last year. He said commodities from Ukraine and Russia, such as wheat, maize and fertilizer, have risen nearly 50% in price, making it difficult for parents to provide food and education to their children. Gabon's military leaders say free education will bridge the gap between the rich and the poor that has existed since Gabon got its independence in 1960. Camilla Tutume Leclerc is Minister of National Education.
C'est pourquoi plaçons l'année scolaire 2023-2024.
She says the school year that began on Monday is under the theme of patriotism to give General Nguema enough time to carry out reforms to improve education and living conditions of all civilians. She says Nguema decided enrollment should be free because he wants all children to have access. The ousted president Ali Bongo and his father Omar Bongo Ondimba ruled the Central African state for more than 55 years. Critics say they left behind a failing national education system. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A nationwide blackout hit Nigeria last week when the national electricity grid suffered a complete collapse. Minister of Power Adebayo Adebulu said on X, formerly known as Twitter, that the outage was caused by a fire in one of the country's power plants. He said the fire was extinguished and over half of the connections are back up, with the rest to be fully restored quickly. Professor Barta Nangi is a former Minister of Power and is chairman of Geometric Power Group, an independent power transmission company in Nigeria. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about Nigeria's power challenges, including inadequate production, transmission constraints, and weak infrastructure.
Well, we don't have reliable electricity, that's the bottom line, and this is caused by a number of factors. We don't have adequate power production. The transmission is constrained. The distribution is further severely constrained. The infrastructure is weak. And also there is not a mechanism for adequate investment, particularly by private sector in the power industry. So it is That's really the bottom line.
The immediate past Minister of Power in Nigeria said that Nigeria generates 22,000 megawatts of electricity. Do you think this is enough to serve the needs of the country?
Well, I'm not aware that we have 22,000 megawatts, and I'm not sure where the 22,000 is. I'm aware that we have 13,000 megawatts, roughly. It's called capacity. That's installed capacity. And that even that installed capacity, we can't wheel to drive the transmission infrastructure because of the constraint of the transmission infrastructure itself. And then it's further constrained by distribution infrastructure. Now, whether even 22,000 is enough, no, it's not. The country of 200 million people, you would expect that there should be many times that number. So it's not enough. That's the answer to it.
Another factor is TC, that's Transmission Company of Nigeria, said that the distribution companies do not have the capacity to absorb electricity generated and then distribute same to final consumers. What's your reaction to this, sir?
I wouldn't understand why that would be so. It is true that some companies reject power, but for the most part, there is inadequate power supply in the country. So the transmission, I think what they may be talking about is not about whether people can actually take the power. It is that the distribution infrastructure is not able to take the power if the power was transmitted to it in a lot of places. But actually, because of technical losses from the transmission to the distribution, by the time you go through distribution, let's say that the transformation capacity right now, that is the availability of transmission infrastructure, is 7,000 megawatts. Then the distribution eventually doesn't get that. It gets maybe about 4,000 to 5,000 megawatts. But part of that also is because of that infrastructure, that is the losses on transmission. It's like that thing they say, lost in transmission. And that's literal, yeah.
That was Professor Barthi Nanji, former Nigerian Minister of Power, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye by phone from Aba in southeast Nigeria. The government of the Republic of Congo yesterday denied rumors of a military coup while President Denis Sassou Nguesso is attending the United Nations General Assembly this week in New York. Social media posts alleged the military was taking over. Terry Mungala, the Congo-Brazzaville Minister of Information, tweeted yesterday that it was fake news. Nguesso became president in a coup in 1979, but lost in the country's first multi-party elections in 1992. He returned to the presidency in 1997 after a period of civil conflict. The rumors and denials of a coup come less than 3 weeks after the military in Gabon ousted President Ali Bongo Ondimba, hours after he was declared winner of national elections. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Helen Cordeon, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Balance. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.